we have all of them in series, then this is what our tuner is doing. It is actually trying to take one or two components of it, which is the inductive reactance and capacitive reactance, and tune it so the resistive part of it is not important. Intuition.
Okay, Wes, by the way, AC2GS. This kind of goes back to what I said before. I hate repeating myself, but what the heck. If you have a dipole, a center-fed, a half-wave dipole, mechanically cut to resonance, and you apply a signal, it will reflect back and forth and produce perfect standing waves, and those will radiate off. And if you measure, you will find that whatever reactive inductances have balanced and zeroed out. So in other words, any inherent capacitance in a resonant antenna minus the inductive reactance is zero. And so all that's left is the resistance. Now, you want very little insertion loss resistance, because that type of resistance will turn your RF into heat, and heat is not useful. You want radiation resistance, in which most of the energy is dissipated like a resistor, but instead of as waste heat, it's radiated as effective electromagnetic modulated waves. If you build something too short, it will have a little bit too much capacitive reactance. If you build it a little long, it'll have a little too much inductive reactance. You can correct those inside the antenna. You can connect them. You can correct them at the feed point. You could correct them at the antenna tuner at the other end of your transmission line. But one way or the other, you have to correct for the excessive reactance in order to produce a standing wave pattern on your radiating antennas, which is the way that standing waves work as opposed to traveling waves.
Do you have another puzzle?
November 2, Silver Charlie?
Yes, John.
I was reading and I constructed a couple of balance to choke off some RF in the shack. And it seems that the gentlemen that write about these, that there's a few of them, they differ somewhat in their methods and opinions, but the ones that seem to have a following. Something they said, one gentleman that confused me, was that in the balance, according to their formulas, what they were trying to achieve was no inductive reactance and no capacitive reactance in the balance, purely resistive, which, you know, to me, seemed like, well, if you're trying to choke off the common mode current, and, you know, impedance is impedance, but he seems to, you know, have the strong argument that he's putting forth that pure resistance with no impedance, rather, you know, no inductive or capacitive reactance is what you wanted. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, unfortunately, there's no such thing as you know, whether it's common mode or not, it's impedance. All these chokes tend to affect common mode currents. There are two different types of currents going on in your transmission line. The good one is the one that you're initially sending up to your antenna. That's differential mode. Differential mode is two different currents, one traveling on your center conductor and one traveling on the inner aspect of your shield. When one is positive, the other is negative, and so it's a difference, and it's self-contained and it's self-shielded. And why we love coax is you can put five coax cables right next to each other, and the amount of isolation that one has for the other is, you know, 120 dB plus. Unfortunately, though, when you get reflections, some of your reflections come back in what's called common mode. Common mode is different than differential mode. Common mode is another current that's traveling on the outer aspect of the shield. So because of the skin effect, the differential is on the inner aspect of the shield. The common mode is on the outer aspect of the shield, and it's the same polarity as the inner aspect of the shield. So rather than differential mode, it's in common mode. In common mode, it can radiate. In common mode, if it goes through an inductor, it can be impeded. Whereas in differential mode, the two impedances cancel out. So it's a big difference whether it's common mode or differential mode for RF chokes. Otherwise, we couldn't use them because they would choke the differential mode as well.
Okay, I think what you're saying, and I just want to clear it up, because I really didn't make any sense to the end. That's not my part. Nice explanation. Thank you. Is that the stroke, you want it so that it's not, doesn't have any reaction to the differential mode, but then it has resistance to the common mode. Is that correct?
I would tweak that and say that it has a high impedance because most of it is inductive reactive. But effectively, they're very similar concepts. So it's not a matter of resistance in the case of an RF choke. It's an impedance.
Okay, maybe I didn't articulate it correctly, but the gentleman, I could find his stuff. He's one of the top guys out there with these balance. And I went with his design, and I don't recall the call sign at the moment. But in all of his diagrams that he gave, his oscilloscope, etc., his balance was designed, and he put forth that the ideal balance has no reductive or inductive or capacitive reaction. It's purely resistant. And that once you have inductive or capacitive reaction, it lowers the value of the balun. Now, I didn't see anybody else saying this, just him. He does seem to, have a following. I don't know if he's an authority in this field. And I just want to know if there is any, in your opinion, any truth to saying.
Yes, Wesley recognized. One sec, Wesley. There are balans that provide common mode choking, and there are balans that do not. So it is possible to have a balan that is purely designed to do the conversion of a balanced to unbalanced line without an additional common mode impedance in the circuit. So you'll find sometimes people using a balun and then using an RF choke below the balun. It depends upon the design. Wesley, you wanted to say something on this?
You just said it.
Okay. I didn't mean to steal your steam.
No problem. But anyhow, just for fun of it, you're a 50-ohm purely resistive device, and you connect it to 50-ohm transmission line. Tell me that this is not a perfect antenna, and to XGN.
Well, it may be the perfect antenna, or it may be the perfect dummy load.
I agree with that, and to XGN.
Okay, very good. Well, it is 10:15. It's 10:16. I'm already late. Anyway, want to thank everyone tonight. It started kind of slow, but it worked its way up, so I'm thankful for that. I hope some people will check out the Red Blood Moon. We have a lunar eclipse, as I mentioned a bit earlier. So once again, thanks to everyone. Just want to remind people that if you want to contact me via email for mailbag questions or topics of discussion or offer some puzzles or me to tap Paul on the shoulder, you can contact me at mailbag@ac2gs.com. You can contact Paul at SpaceNet Report at gmail.com. The link page, take a look at it. One of these days, I promise you, I will go to the radiometer story one of these days. But until then, the link page is roy.ac2gs.com. Then there's the stream for Glen Oaks repeater. That's at technet.ac2gs.com. And, of course, MikeKC2NJI's amateurradio.tv for archives of these technical nets that go as far back as 2006, September of 2006. So keep that all in mind. And thanks, everyone, once again. And here's Paul with the SpaceNet report.
AC2GS WS2N. And it still looks cloudy out there. So hopefully there'll be a break in the clouds if anybody wants to go look at this later. If not, NASA will start transmitting it on their NASA TV station at 11 o'clock. You know, they start from on. But I think full totality, I think, was 12:10. 12:11. Anyway, that will be the eclipse for tonight, the lunar eclipse. Another one for our area will be until 2025. There you go. Always interesting to see the moon disappear, but I don't think it's going to be. No, well, not for Suffolk County anyway, where I am. Any questions or comments before we continue with the net, the WS question? Okay. Anyway, there is going to be an important launch as far as I'm concerned on Thursday. around 7 o'clock, 6:54 p.m. So I'll get on NASA TV for that. And that will be a Starliner launch from Launch Complex 41 in Florida. It's going to be a Starliner / Atlas V launch. The Atlas V is a rocket that will launch the spacecraft to orbit, and once it gets to orbit, it will find its way about 24 hours later to the International Space Station. It's unmanned right now, but if it's successful, it will eventually be capable of carrying a crew of four on a regular basis to the space station. It's designed to actually carry seven people, but the regular crew will be a total of four, same as what the Dragon spacecraft has been doing for the last couple of years. Once they get into full, standard rotations, they'll have, SpaceX Dragon crew go up, and then they'll have the Boeing Starliner go up after that, rotating roughly every 6 months with new crews. So NASA's anxious to get this. They've always been big on redundancy. And if I think back years ago, they always had multiple vehicles. You had two Viking landers land on Mars. You had two Voyager spacecraft going to the outer reaches of the solar system and beyond, and coming back, as well as the Pioneers. They did the same thing, Pioneers 10 and 11. They passed, one of them passed Jupiter and kept on going, and the other one eventually passed Saturn and kept on going with, redundancy. So, say something happens to SpaceX vehicle, the Dragon crew vehicle, they come up with a glitch or a problem where they have to work on it. Sometimes these things take months or 6 months or maybe a year to fix. You need a plan B, and that's what they'll have with the Starliner Boeing. Launches on the Atlas V rocket, which presently is the biggest rocket that NASA uses in its configuration. They have two solid boosters attached to the Atlas V. They also have the second stage is a cryogenic liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen rocket. They literally left launched hundreds of these things over the years, see those, you look in the back and you always see this, this one rocket, you know, this one exhaust sticking out. And that, that's most of the flights have gone like that, except for this crew vehicle will have two engines on board side by side. So instead of putting out roughly 25,000 pounds of thrust, you have 50,000 pounds of thrust on the second stage with a lot more fuel. This gives the crew, once this thing is accepted by NASA and they approve it and you start flying crews on it, you don't want to blast them off where they stick to the back of the vehicle at, you know, 12 Gs or something. So to do that, to have a nice ride all the way up around 3 Gs, they need more fuel and they just accelerate more slowly over a longer period of time. So we'll see how this mission goes. The idea is to get it to orbit and then start using its thrusters to maneuver its way to the International Space Station. Once there, 24 hours later, it will dock to the front end of the International Space Station. The front end is, you know, most of those modules you see in the front are the U.S. or from the European Space Agency. The Russian modules are all in the rear of the space station. And it's going to attach to the front, in this case, the Harmony module. And in front of the Harmony module, they have a pressure mating adapter. This one's called pressure mating adapter too. And two docking collars will come together. There were roughly a 1 meter diameter opening, and that's how the crew eventually enters into the space station. Dragon did this years ago, almost 3 years ago. They did the same thing. They launched an unmanned vehicle, got to the space station, stayed there for a period of time, eventually undocked, and flew back and landed. They have splashdowns for the Dragon. They land in the water, and SpaceX comes along with their own ship, picks up the Dragon, and they bring it home that way, and it's reusable. Starliner is also reusable. The big difference there is, when they undock the space station, they'll deorbit, and instead of doing a splashdown, they actually land. They'll land in New Mexico, White Sands, New Mexico. And they've actually done that once already. A little over 2 years ago, it was in December of 2019. They launched the exact same setup. Starliner, that was their first test, and it was supposed to do all this. Go to the space station, come back, land in New Mexico. But they had problems with the software. They never made it to the proper orbit. There was a timing glitch between the spacecraft and mission control. The spacecraft thought it was in a different location and kept firing its thrusters to try to compensate for that. In doing it, it actually used up most of its fuel. By the time NASA straightened this all out, they knew they didn't have enough fuel to make it to the space station and back. So they just deorbited the Starliner, and then it came back and successfully landed in New Mexico. So it won't be the first time they're doing this. It comes down with a parachute, a heat shield, a parachute. And then eventually that heat shield comes off toward the end, and that exposes the bottom. They have these big, six gigantic airbags. Call them airbags, and they puff up at the last second, and that gives them an extra soft landing when they land on land. So it worked fine last time. They'll do it again this time. If this all works out within months, or depending on the timing of when another crew could go up there, the next time they use Starliner, we'll have a crew on it. Instead of four people, they're going to start off with three on the first mission, but after that, they'll go right up to four. Anyway, this is WSUN. So, looking forward to that launch. On board, they're going to bring a mannequin up there, and they got all kinds of pressure gauges and things attached to it, to the mannequin, to duplicate, you know, to try to figure out what, you know, all the G's and everything is supposed to match everything that they expect. So, you know, when the thing is actually attached to the space station, the crew on board, right now we have, seven people on board, you will have people opening up the hatchway and going inside Starliner, which I think is going to be great. It's a little bit more roomier. I think it's got about 100 more cubic feet than Dragon does. And NASA will send them back pictures, and I'm sure they'll have interviews on NASA TV with people inside the Starliner. It'll probably stay there between 5 and 10 days attached to the space station. On the way up, they're going to bring 500 to 600 pounds of stuff, maybe food, and put some equipment on board. Usually a cargo vehicle goes up, and they can nothing to bring it up, you know, 7,000, 8,000, 10,000 pounds of stuff to the space station, depending on the vehicle that goes up there. Here, well, this is a test for a crew, so but since it's going up, they're going to bring up around 600 pounds worth of clothes and food to the astronauts. And on the way back, they're going to bring another 500 to 600 pounds worth of experiments and things that need to be returned to Earth. That's the other good thing. Dragon right now is the only vehicle, besides the Russians, but the only vehicle that's capable of bringing not only crews up, but it brings up cargo. So you have the cargo version of the Dragon, so you know, you might bring up 5,000 pounds of stuff, and you might come back with 4,000 or 5,000 pounds of equipment and science stuff, and, you know, and now you have another vehicle to do that as well. The other cargo vehicles that go up are Cygnus and Progress from the Russians. But they don't land on land, and they don't land on water. They just burn up over the South Pacific. And we used to have another spacecraft cargo vehicle that used to go up to the space station as well, called the ATV, the Automatic Transit Vehicle, built by European Space Agency. They used to launch that out of French Guiana around in once a year or so they would launch that. That was a large rocket, you know. It was, two very big solid boosters attached to it. And the spacecraft itself was very large. It used to bring like 13,000 pounds of stuff worth on each flight up to the space station. They used to dock to the Russian end of it. And they ran five of those flights over the years, roughly once every year. So, but NASA liked that vehicle. They liked the ATV so much that they gave European Space Agency a contract to make something very similar to the ATV vehicle for the service module of the Artemis program, which hopefully we'll start to see being launched in a couple of months, maybe June or July, or hopefully August, would be the first unmanned launch of Artemis with the Orion spacecraft. So that service module designed from the automatic transit vehicle that used to visit the space station on a regular basis will be the service module to Orion. And eventually, of course, they will have crews. Hopefully go to the moon with that. Any questions? WS.
Paul?
Hi, Roy. What's up?
Yeah, I didn't have any particular questions, but EchoLink was down, and occasionally when I do this, it brings it back up, and it brought it back up. So, mission accomplished.
Okay, let me stand by and see if anybody's saying anything. I tend to not do that. This is WS2S.
Yeah, Paul, I just wanted to say hello, and hopefully the Starliner will actually work this time. That would be cool. Otherwise, I suspect NASA's going to ditch them. Go ahead, Paul.
Good to hear you, Frank, and yeah, I agree. And, wow, that would be a big loss, you know, NASA's invested a lot of seed money into that project, $2 billion. They also gave them a $4 billion contract for six flights to the International Space Station. Six scheduled flights. So not this one and not the next one with a crew of three. They're considered test flights by Boeing. But the ones that follow, they plan on six more flights. Every 6 months or so, for at least 3 years, and if that goes well, they'll give them more contracts as well to do that, similar to what they did with SpaceX. But there is some concern, but I think Boeing knows how to get around it with the Atlas V. The Atlas V is what takes Starliner up. Atlas V is a very reliable rocket. They've been, I don't know how many flights there is. I think it's well over 100 flights on the Atlas V rocket. There was an Atlas II, and there was an Atlas, three and four. Correction, there wasn't a two, they skipped two. But anyway, they've had Atlas versions. Now, this has been the Atlas V for, the end of the 1990s. But the deal is they use RD-180 engines that are built by the Russians, actually, part of the Ukraine at the time when these things were being built. And over the years, NASA has bought them up, and there's a whole bunch of storage that we still have. And our crews, rework them to retune them to what we need. On the RD-180. Very successful. Not one has ever failed. Very reliable. But, once we had problems with Russia due to the invasion of Crimea and the Donbass area in 2014, Congress decided, that we have to change. You can't change overnight. So they've put out these different contracts. Aerojet had one, it's called the AR-1. Blue Origin had another one called the BE-4. And these were, 500,000 pound thrust engines that they were trying to build. And Blue Origin got the contract to replace the engines on the Atlas V rocket. And they were, going to do away with the RD-180s and put two BE-4s. These things were they were designing with liquid methane at the time, and they said, "Well, we can't do that. We have to change the tanks and everything." So they did away with that idea, and they said, "Well, we're building new rockets anyway, called the Vulcan rocket. We'll just make sure these new BE-4 liquid methane, liquid oxygen engines get installed in that, because that thing is being designed to replace the Atlas V rocket. And all was supposed to be well, that thing was supposed to be flying a couple of years ago. Like a lot of things, it was delayed, and from my understanding, it's still supposed to make the first test by the end of the year, but I don't see any deliveries of the AE-4 engine being built by Blue Origin delivered to Boeing. The Boeing says they're coming, but if you read this stuff every day, I haven't seen any deliveries to Boeing from Blue Origin. But once they do, they'll attach them to the new Vulcan rocket. They have that thing built. In fact, they ran some tests. They put it out at the launch facility to make sure everything works and fits right when they actually go to launch one of these things. But sooner or later, they'll get their BE-4 engines, and that will be the new rocket. Now, it's not human rated yet. You have to fly a couple of rockets. I think the first one's going to go to the moon, and it's going to deliver a robotic mission to the moon on the new Vulcan rocket. and then another mission or two after that. And then at that time, then they say, well, it'll be human rated. Now, will they take an existing Starliner and put it on top, put a crew right in, or are they going to have another unmanned launch as a test of working the Vulcan rocket with the Starliner at the same time? I don't know. So there's a lot of questions, delays, maybe, you know, but hopefully that works out, because right now, I've read that Boeing only has enough Atlas V launches left. Atlas V has already got a manifest for other launches, but there's only two more planned missions, that they have left for that. And then they also launched the Cygnus vehicle. They can launch a Cygnus vehicle, a crew vehicle, cargo vehicle on Atlas V. And they might have to do that. Why do they have to do that? Because the Cygnus is being launched on an Antares rocket from Wallops Island, Virginia. And what engines are they running? They're running the RD-181 engines, also Russian engines. And they have a warehouse not filled with these things, but enough for a couple of more launches for their unmanned cargo vehicle, Cygnus, to the International Space Station. Okay, so now, you know, we're running out of engines here. We're running out of time to get launches up and running. They really need the Vulcan rocket completed. And hopefully Blue Origin gets the deliveries going on these things. And not one liquid oxygen rocket has ever been launched into orbit yet in the whole world. So it's a completely new technology. Everybody's rolling the dice on this. We'll see. They've launched liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen rockets. The Japanese H2, when they launch from Japan, uses that. The space shuttle, all the space shuttles use that with that big orange tank was filled with liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen. The same for the Ariane 5 rocket that I mentioned before that took the ATVs up, the cargo vehicles from Kourou, French Guiana. That was liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen. Other rocket fuels they use some older ones, which everybody's getting away from because they're carcinogenic. But unsymmetric dimethylhydrogen fuel, and they mix that with nitrogen tetroxide, and that's the oxidizer. Anyway, they everybody's getting away from that, including the Chinese. They want to get away from that as well. But the most common one is RP-1, which is a liquid kerosene rocket, liquid kerosene, liquid oxygen. But now all of a sudden everybody's into this methane, liquid methane. You have the Vulcan rocket, and now the Starship vehicle that's being built by SpaceX. That's supposed to be launched with, they're going to start off, I think, with 28, eventually wind up with 33 Raptor engines, all running on liquid methane, liquid oxygen. So talk about a dynamic system, you know. I mean, you know, you take modern technology, which is all rocketry, but they don't find one thing that works and stick with it, you know. They don't make a million Volkswagens. Everything's a new vehicle. Without mass production, costs go up. These are all multi-billion dollar projects. Any questions? WSLM. Nothing heard. I assume Echo Link is still connected. Well, okay. Here's an interesting thing that SpaceX wants to do in November. They're going to launch a Falcon 9 rocket from Launch Complex 39A in Florida. A crew vehicle. Nothing to do with NASA whatsoever. Another private mission. They just launched a private mission called Axiom 1 up to the International Space Station. They spent, they were supposed to spend 8 days there, but they spent an extra 4 days there because of bad weather. But, you know, that was an arrangement with NASA to send this private crew, Axiom, on a SpaceX rocket. And they stayed, quite a while on the space station. Eventually they deorbited it and landed in the Gulf of Mexico successfully. All well and good. Well, now the same company is planning on launching this crew of four. It's not Axiom, but it's another private mission. And, you know, you had a crew of four go up a year or so ago, and they orbited the Earth. They didn't dock to the International Space Station, and they just orbited the Earth. They had a viewpoint, a port that they looked at. They had this globe on top. Eventually, they came back, and that was successful. That was all part of donations to St. Jude Hospital. Well, that went well. But so now that same guy, this one guy, Jared Isaacman, he's the billionaire behind this. He pays SpaceX. They still don't say how much money he's paying him to launch himself, and the last one was three people. So it was a crew of four. Now he's going to do another crew of four, and he's going to
launch in a very high orbit, an elliptical orbit. He wants to go up like 850 miles and then come back down around 200 miles. So apogee and perigee. Apogee will be all the way up to 850 miles. He's trying to beat the record from Gemini 11. They had the highest record. The time NASA was testing out docking with another vehicle and seeing if this other vehicle could use its rocket to launch them to a higher orbit, getting ready for Apollo, and which they did. Gemini 11 came, flew to orbit, regular orbit, and low Earth orbit, maybe 150 miles, 175 miles up. They docked with the Agena spacecraft, the unmanned vehicle, and then the Agena spacecraft lit its rocket and flew them up to like 800 miles high, and they made sure everything worked. That was fine. They came back. There was a real good purpose for doing something like that. They haven't explained the purpose why they want to send this crew up to 850 miles an hour, 850 miles high. The only thing I can think of is they just want a record. They just want to see if they can beat that record. I don't get it, but maybe there's something more to it that I'm missing. But anyway, this crew is going to go up that high, and eventually the Dragon will fire its thrusters and bring it back to the circular orbit. Maybe like 300 miles above the surface. Again, this thing is not going to dock with the International Space Station. They'll be in orbit. They've replaced the globe on the front of the older spacecraft, the one that they flew last time, where we had people from St. Jude, and those four people went up. Two women that experienced that. They replaced that globe, so now you can't look out. So they're going one step better. They put a hatch on the front. Well, there's always a hatch on the front anyway, because if you dock with the space station, the hatch opens up in the front, and that's how you get in and out of the Dragon vehicle. So now this hatch is back in place. They plan on doing an EVA, spacewalk, extravehicular activity. Two of them are planning on doing this thing. SpaceX designed their own spacesuits, nothing similar to what NASA has. The smaller, lightweight spacesuits. And they plan on opening the hatch and having one guy and maybe two guys float outside and do an EVA around 300 miles. Not at the 800 mile level, but in orbit, a circular orbit around the Earth. They don't say how long they plan on
being out there. They don't say why they're going out there. They do say that they're testing the spacesuits. But, yeah, I don't know, it sounds a little risky to me. Not only that, they don't have an airlock system. The spacecraft is only so big, you know. So they don't have room to put an airlock in. So that means the other let's say two people go out for a spacewalk, which is what they usually do. NASA always does anyway. They always have to send two people out. You know, God forbid something goes wrong. So now, if they had an airlock, they could close the door and the two people inside could be, you know, in a shirt sleeve environment. But no airlock. So all four are going to have these spacesuits on because they're going to depressurize the whole thing. The two people will go out and do a spacewalk. They don't say that they're installing external handles on the outside. Nothing like that. I'm sure they're going to do something. They don't want a wild situation like Eugene Cernan had on a Gemini flight, where he lost 10 pounds of moisture because he couldn't get back into the spacecraft because there were no handles. And he was out of control. So I'm sure he'll do something like that. But again, they're going to actually take off in these spaces. When NASA does, send people up in a space shuttle, you have flight suits. Everybody has flight suits. You know, you send usually up to seven people on the space shuttle. Seven flight suits, they take off and land in that. But they always have maybe two. They always had two. If they were doing an EVA, they had two EVA suits also up there. So two guys would do the EVAs and get into that. Those space suits and go through the airlock, and everybody else would stay comfortable on the other side. But not this. This is like the old days when it was the old Gemini flight. There was no airlock on that either. One guy would go out, and the other guy would still be in there in his space suit just in case there was a problem. You could maybe pull him in. So I don't know if I'm. I don't. You know, I have to read more about this. I'm sure. There's got to be more to it than it sounds like they just want to be the first ones to have a commercial EVA right now. But I hope that's not the case. Being private, you don't read as much as what we would normally get on a public NASA mission. Another thing I don't like about it is at least I haven't read it, these suits don't look like they have any, they call them safer system. Safer system was developed by NASA. When you have a backpack on, it's another like backpack type of thing that attaches to the top of the backpack. And it comes down, on the sides by your arms. And the safety unit is designed that if you, for some reason, start floating away from the spacecraft, they have tethers when they do a spacewalk and all, but for some reason you got loose. The safer unit you could operate, it could get you back to the shuttle or the International Space Station if they started floating away. Hopefully they have it. I haven't read that they do. I think if they did, they would have published that. Anyway, any questions? This is WS2N for the TACNET Space Net Report. Okay, I guess not. As far as the International Space Station goes, they are always growing food on the space station for the last, I don't know how many years. They have the veggie system and all, and they have this hydroponic system going, and they have LED lights, and they've made vegetables, and they've eaten them on board. They've sent them back to Earth to see if they're any good. And they have roughly one square meter dedicated to growing stuff on the space station. In the Destiny module, but now there's a Columbus module as well by the European Space Agency, and recently they've started to prepare a section over there for more things to grow in space. But eventually, you need a place to go. Right now they have a place to go called the Space Station. Eventually they want to go to places like the Moon or Mars. Once you get to the Moon, can you set up a greenhouse and grow things? Well, you can't bring millions of tons of dirt. Well, you could, but it would cost a fortune from Earth. Is the what is it? I think every pound costs you $10,000 just to get to orbit or some formula that they used to use years ago. SpaceX is trying to get it down to $1,000 per pound. But just to get it to the moon, I think it's, you know, I don't know, three or four times that amount. So you would like to be able to grow things on the moon if you could. So the scientists have actually started doing that. Not on the moon, but they're taking the regolith, let's call it the dirt of the moon, from the last Apollo missions that flew to the moon. We've had six manned missions to that have landed on the moon and returned, and each one has brought rocks and regolith back. There was quite a few canisters at the end that NASA didn't open up. They sealed up, and that's it. We're putting it in this, you know, super vacuum temperature control location. We're going to open up 50 years from now, and by then we're going to have scientists that could do stuff with this, investigate, find out things that, you know, with equipment that we don't have in 1972. Here it is, 2022, and they've done that. They've actually opened up those cylinders a while back, and they've done experiments with it. And, you know, all the scientists are very thrilled to be doing this. Because we don't have any other stuff coming back, you know, unless you want to go steal the stuff that the Chinese flew back recently, which was, I don't know, a pound or two of stuff. So we bought a total of 850 pounds of stuff back from the moon. So we had a lot of stuff. I mean, they had so much they were giving away to foreign countries. Anyway, they've taken the regolith from these last canisters that they opened up, and they're trying to grow little vegetables or, you know, in it, and they succeeded. They had a control group of like regular soil, and then they used let's call it the dirt from the moon, and the exact same stuff, and they are using growing lights, LED lights to make the stuff grow. And sure enough, it actually started to grow, and it has pictures on the website. If you go to the NASA website, you can see the pictures. And one picture was good. They have what it looks like in regular soil, what it looks like the regular soil looks better, bigger, greener things. But, you know, the other side, it's working. It's just not as good. So naturally, they'll be able to tweak that over time, and you know, I guess they envision someday having maybe a greenhouse set up on a moon, growing their own food. So I thought that was pretty amazing. I should backtrack in a minute. I was talking about the mission that's going up on Thursday, the Starliner mission from Florida. You know, I was talking about they're going to dock with the Harmony module. Forward-facing module. The Harmony module has six ports. You know, one main port is attached to the main part of the space station, and then you have the port side and the starboard side. The port side is attached to another gigantic module called Kaibo module, and then the starboard side that's attached to the Columbus module by the European Space Agency. Then you have three other ports, one facing down. And they use that for cargo vehicles that are docked at the space station. Cargo vehicles have a bigger diameter opening, so you're able to get bigger things, spaces, you know, big things that, you know, science projects, racks maybe, through it. They have like a 53-inch opening where the openings on the on manned vehicles are only 1 meter in diameter. So they have these docking ports, and they're called pressure mating adapters. Well, there's pressure mating adapter number two that's facing out, and that's one that Starliner is going to attach to. And there's one on the top, on the Zenith, the top one called pressure mating adapter number three. And right now is a crew Dragon vehicle attached to that. Because right now you have four people that were set up by NASA in the space station. You also have three Russians in there, so that's why you have total seven people on the space station. So that, anyway, the Starline is going to attack, attached to the front end of the space station. So I sent a picture of, I've actually done this
complete.
Before, because like I said, back in a little over 2 years ago, December 2019, they did send their Starliner up to the space station. Anyway, I sent the picture to Roy. Roy's put it on his website. It looks pretty good on the way it's going to look with this thing approaching the Starliner, approaching the pressure rating adapter within the same picture, you see a Dragon attached to the Zenith port. But the picture really came out good on his website. Anyway, further questions, any comments, WS2N. Okay, I just want to mention the, we always try to cover the foreign launches as well. A week or so ago, the Chinese launched the vehicle to, the cargo vehicle to their space station. It's amazing that we actually, because the human race actually has two space stations up there right now. They have their own, and they call it the Tianzhou cargo vehicle. They successfully launched from the Wenchang launch facility on southeastern China border. They have like five launch facilities all throughout China, you know, Gobi Desert and all. But this is a new one, and they launched from there, and they docked with their space station. You know, completely autonomous. They only, in fact, the people that were on board came back recently. So it's unmanned. Right? The space station is unmanned. So this cargo vehicle filled with food and stuff for the space station. It's called the Tianzhou cargo spacecraft. It's now attached to the Chinese space station. Waiting for another crew that's going to launch from Wenchang launch facility in China not too long from now. So you'll have another crew of three going up there. And they save a month at a time now. So, they're coming a long way, that's for sure. Any comments or questions before I turn it back to Roy? Nothing heard. We'll do just that. Thank everybody that listened to me. We'll be on again tomorrow night when we have a Club Info Net on these repeaters, followed by George, KD2FIU, who does the swap and shop, followed by Newsline. But now I'm turning back to Roy, AC2GS, WS2N.
Okay, apparently someone finally settled down. This is AC2GS. Thank you, Paul. Thank you for the SpaceNet report. Thank you for all that you do on this TechNet, and thank you for all that you do with the club. Just want to point out that I was mentioning earlier that there's only so many things that I can do. Usually during the TechNet, I'm watching Echolink. I'm checking IRLP. I'm checking the audio stream. I'm checking the chat room, and email, and a bunch of other things, and listening, and talking, and doing all kinds of things, but, you know, very difficult to kind of read articles. But in addition to all the other things, I've been playing around with Whisper. I have it hooked up to my 10-meter serial 5/8 wave, and during the TechNet, I got pinged by a gentleman in Australia. So that's interesting. Anyway, thanks to everyone who participated tonight. I appreciate it. No one wants to just hear me drone on. So to the people that asked questions, to the others that offered answers, opinions, and brought up other side questions, I thank you all. As always, want to remind you, email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Link page is roy.ac2gs.com. And of course, keep in mind that Mike KC2NJI's amateurradio.tv has archives of this technical net going as far back as 2006, September. So please, be safe, be smart, be well, take care of yourself, take care of each other, be good to each other, and hopefully come back next Sunday with a bunch of questions or topics of discussion, and we'll try and see if we can do this all over again. This is AC2GS closing formally the Blood Red Moon edition of the Limark Technical Net, and I am clear.
W2VL repeater. That tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
Limark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. Limark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. Limark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. Limark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
This is the W2VL repeater. Good morning. The time is 5 o'clock a.m.
Limark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater.
Peter, K1NDF, listen, Long Island, New York, over.
This is KD2FHI, mobile, heading towards the city. You held the repeater that time. This is Kilo Delta 2, Foxtrot Hotel, India.
Where's this repeater located? Over.
This is the Glen Oaks repeater of the Limark Radio Club. Over.
What is it again?
Limark, Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club. They're located here in Long Island. It is the repeater that you're touching is at the Glen Oaks location, which is, I believe, the North Shore Towers. Over.
Yep, my name is Neil. I'm in Framingham.